Curious Talks with Leif and Elfie.
Each episode, we're unpacking the brains of experts from around the universe.
Today, we're deep diving into this topic of sex and porn addiction. We're joined by Mig Bennett, who is a fully qualified relationship counsellor specialising in relationship problems, sexual issues and sex addiction, with over 25 years of experience, both in her own private practice and for Relate.
Welcome, Mig. It's lovely to meet you.
Hi. Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. So can you give us a little bit of your background, how you got to be involved in your job? Because it's a little bit unusual, isn't it?
It is, I guess. I started off nearly 30 years ago. I trained for Relate as a relationship counsellor, and I still work for them. And I've only worked with couples and relationships. So anything along those lines I've worked with for years. And then about 8 or 9 years ago, I began to realise that we were getting very different cases where there were men who were addicted to sexual behaviours. And it was quite new, well, new to me, although in America they'd been looking at it for quite a while. And I had one particular couple that I had to literally keep one step ahead of them because I didn't know enough about it. And then that they actually encouraged me to train. And I then did the training about the sex addiction training, which you can now do in the UK.
And you mentioned it's 8 or 9 years ago, so it's relatively new. Why do you think that is? Was there a trend maybe in the sort of digital revolution, or do you think there's a connection there?
Yes, I do. And I think people have said that, particularly the older people that I see. It used to be something that they could manage because they had to go buy a magazine or buy a DVD, whereas now it's in their pockets on the smartphones. And definitely it has come to the fore. I mean, 30 years, it just wasn't around then. I'm sure it was, but we didn't know about it. And it was far more difficult to become addicted, although there have always been people visiting sex workers and watching porn. But nowadays it's incredible. Quite quickly, 50% of my cases are sexual compulsivity.
And is it mostly men who are affected, or what does someone look like who's... What is a sex addiction actually, Mig? How would you sort of define that?
Well, it isn't somebody who likes sex. It's not somebody who's got a high libido, the sort of jokey stuff that you get in the pub, you know, about, oh, you're addicted to sex. It isn't that at all. So it's not a high libido, but it's any form of sexual behaviour that is out of control, really. Anything that a bit like, you know, we're not all alcoholics, but we drink. A lot of us drink. We're not all sex addicts, but a lot of us watch porn. It's when it becomes something you can't stop. So the factors you need to look for are: have you tried to stop and failed, and tried again and failed? That's a really big pointer. And is it increasing in time and intensity? And what can it be? Well, it can be porn, masturbation, usually. It's a sexual arousal with masturbation to porn. That can then lead into sex clubs, sex workers, massage parlours. Then there's also the multi-affairs, where people just have one-night stands and they have them again and again and again. And then there are the more emotional or romantic addictions to chat lines and dating sites, where it is about the connection, the fantasy connection with somebody. Usually they masturbate to the conversation, or afterwards to the fantasy of the conversation. So it's those sort of areas, out of control, any of those.
And I suppose it is a lot easier, isn't it, to, like, you have Tinder, where some people use it to have sex, so it's a lot more available.
Yes, and they are not addicts unless they are doing it so much that they can't stop and it's taking hours of their time and they are having any of the difficulties that come along with sort of sexual compulsivity, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a moment, because it does have negative side effects.
Yeah, what kind of negative? I imagine some of the partners are unhappy with the visiting sex workers, but
even before that, they've found out, there will be generally there'll be a level of tiredness because they're probably getting no sleep. They're up until all hours, a level of not being engaged in the relationship, because they're, some of the women I've spoken to talk about this bubble effect, as do the men, that they're in a sort of brain fog, like a bubble, and they can spot that their partner is just not with them. They're sort of either still in their fantasy world or planning their next hit. It's a bit like the you know, waiting till the next cocaine or whatever the drug of choice is. But with these people, it's sex. So tiredness, they can be edgy. They're always waiting for the next hit. They have probably lower libido, and their wives will suddenly think that they aren't, they're not interested in sex anymore. A, because they're tired. B, because they can't get the level of excitement with the partner. And B, because they've masturbated themselves to the point where they are not going to be able to get that level of erection when they want to with their partner. So, yeah, lots of side effects. People lose their jobs because they're online at work. They lose their relationships. They lose a lot of money if they're paying for sex workers or for the pay-to-play type chat lines. So there's a lot of money also involved.
Gosh, so I thought it was interesting when you said about a brain fog, because there's some various groups online of quite a range of men, but quite often young men who are addicted to online porn, and they talk about the benefits of giving up masturbation and watching porn. Is that something that you see in your treatment work as well?
Yes, I'm just thinking of one guy as you said that, and he talks about when he's in acting out, as they call it, when he is acting out, he talks about having like this sickly sweet feeling. It's like a sickly sweet head space. And when he is in, he then has to go through withdrawal, which is horrible. And then you come through into recovery, and gradually you begin to see everything with much more clarity. It's sharper, it's cleaner, you're really tasting and smelling and seeing life as it is, including relationships.
Gosh, is that a reaction to not masturbating, or is that just the addiction? Not
any of the acting out space? Yeah, it's the addiction, really. Oh, it's the dopamine, because all the addictions are about what's going on in our brain. If you think about, you know, we're putting a behavioural substance into our brain. We do it with alcohol, we do it with drugs, but in behavioural addictions, we put it in like gambling. We put it in with our behaviours, but it's all the same thing. And our brain's reward pathways like what they feel, because dopamine gives them a nice high, so they get a good feeling, a good reward. So they seek more of it. That's how we're programmed, you know, as mammals, we're programmed to seek sex because we want to procreate. But we then have, with the modern world, there was no pornography, obviously, in donkey's years ago, but we now sort of have muddled the two, and we hijacked sex with porn. And some of the addict, for example, can't tell porn from sex. It gives him that buzz, that high.
In terms of treatment, though, is it sort of similar to other addictions whereby, like, if you're an alcoholic, like, you can't really go back and ever have alcohol, or you just become addicted again? Like, how do you kind of transition into what is, you know...
what is recovery? Yeah. No, it's different, because if you are an alcoholic or an eating... if you're alcohol, you can stop drinking. Mm. If you gamble, you could stop gambling. Life goes on. But if you have a problem with eating or sex, you can't give them up completely. Mm. They're very similar. So you have to replace what you're taking away, i.e. the negative sexual behaviour or the negative eating behaviour, with a positive attitude to sex. So, yes, we would be aiming for that person to be able to have a positive relationship with sex, to be able to masturbate, to be able to have sex with his partner, but in a positive way where he has control over it, not back in the old pattern of it being something he just can't stop.
You touched upon, Mig, that some men have physical symptoms, that they might find it difficult to become aroused. Is that something you see in perfectly healthy people as well?
Erectile difficulties, you mean? Yeah. When they've been acting out? Mm. Yes. I mean, I think I hope GPs are getting more au fait with sex addiction, but I suspect a lot of men go to the GP for help with erectile problems and are given Viagra, when in fact they're not asked whether they watch a lot of porn. And the porn brings about a lot of erectile problems. Not the porn itself, but the need for a higher overuse and the need for a higher, more hardcore stimulus to get the erection. Mm. And then, of course, when they are having sex in a normal situation, that stimulation isn't there.
And they're kind of discussing quite heteronormative, like,
we are.
And men as well. I'm just wondering about the sort of people that you see. Is there some diversity as well?
There's a lot of sexual addiction amongst gay men. And in fact, one of my female clients, she was in a group for partners. And in that group, there were about 7 women and 1 man whose partner was a male but was addicted to sex. So definitely it's in the gay community, without a doubt. I don't know enough. I haven't come across it in the female lesbian, personally, in the lesbian gay community. But definitely male partners, yes.
Perhaps I'm making assumptions. I know there is women-specific porn sites these days, isn't
there?
Yes,
there are.
But I suppose, I want to say traditionally, but it doesn't feel old enough for that. But I suppose traditionally, pornography watching is more associated with men, isn't it?
But I think it is. I think there is an element of love addiction in sex addiction. There's an element of being addicted to the romance of sex and the chase for sex. And in one of the 12-step self-help groups, or 12-step fellowship groups, is Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and there are as many women in those meetings as there are men. There may be some who are addicted to porn, and I know women who have come to train for this because they've been addicted to porn, which the one I'm thinking about, came across in her work life. She had to sort of get into the zone because all the men around her were watching porn, and she had to brave it out and be okay with it.
Yeah.
And eventually found herself addicted to it. But generally for women, I think, or more generally, it's about that love addiction where they have inappropriate fantasies, crushes, constantly looking for the perhaps somebody who doesn't reciprocate, but they think they're in a relationship with, and it's more, well, they call it love addiction.
Gosh, I always thought love addiction was a bit of a joke. That sounds awful, probably, in your line of work, but I always thought that was just a sort of generalised term for needy sort of women, but it's a real thing.
Well, it will be, probably, but also if they're compulsively unable to stop doing it and they do it all the time and it's ruining their lives and they want to be able to have proper relationships, it's that line between what's compulsive and what's under your control.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit of a spectrum. Sometimes I see people who they can just about stop on their own, like somebody can stop drinking on their own. But then at the further end of the spectrum, they really would not be able to do it on their own.
Do you see sort of attributes of like people who can't be single, for example? They find it very hard to be single. They have to kind of meet someone.
Yes, they need to be in a relationship. But again, there's that compulsive looking constantly, being on multiple chat lines so that they are in 3 or 4 relationships that are making them feel good, making them feel more sexual, making them feel more virile, or for women, making them feel more attractive to men. But they're not real relationships. But it isn't all about porn. That a lot of the ones I see, it is about or includes chat lines. One guy I've been seeing, and he's got a real range that's pornography, chat lines with ex-girlfriends, sexual chat lines with strangers. He'll then go onto one of those online sites and meet up for sex with strangers, oral, penetrative. But there's quite a range for that guy, whereas some of them have one specific, it's just porn. Another one I've worked with for a long time is just the chat lines. He very, very rarely, I think twice, has ever met one of the people he talks to over quite a few years. So it does vary hugely.
Gosh, I've never, perhaps this is my innocence, but I've never really seen the point of chat lines. But I suppose you build rapport with the people that you're speaking to.
It's erotic as well. You're able to say the things that you wouldn't say to somebody face to face.
Yeah.
You can be somebody else. You can pretend to be a much more confident person, a much more sexually confident person. Interestingly, I think that at the heart of a lot of people who are out there acting out quite promiscuously, we think they're promiscuous, they're very confident sexually, it's driven by a lack of confidence in sex. So that they call it sexual anorexia, where in their real life, not their acting out life, not their addicted life, they will do anything, a bit like eating, to avoid sex, like an anorexic avoids eating.
Really?
But then they act out in a way that is able, they're able to not really be having sex. They're doing it in a fantasy way.
I was going to ask, actually, yeah, like, have you noticed, are there patterns of, like, underlying issues of why people may become sex addicts?
Yes. We usually say there are three reasons that are probably in the background. There's opportunity, there's trauma, and there's attachment. So you have to have the opportunity, and opportunity is much bigger now because of the web. Generally, people who are addicted use their drug of choice to soothe. They use it to soothe something that they may not be conscious of. They just know there's something not right. So part of the work needs to be on meaning making. You know, why did you get into this? And often that's because of attachment issues in childhood or trauma. Sometimes both. And sometimes people will have attachment issues and trauma and not become addicts. If you think about soldiers coming back from dreadful war scenes, dreadful traumas, when we hear about them when they're out of the army, some of them have become alcoholics or sex addicts or drug addicts, but not all of them. And the ones that probably have managed the trauma will have had a good attachment. They will have good attachments at their core, you know, family attachments, a good childhood, that sort of thing. Whereas the ones who turn to their drug of choice will probably have not had such stable upbringing, stable, secure bases from which to manage the trauma. So that's part of the work, as well as the helping them to stop, which is the first part of the work. It's about working out why. And sometimes we never can work out why. It clearly, you know, we can hypothesize and we can do an awful lot of soul searching, but we may never really be able to understand why.
Do you think it's likely, obviously during COVID, when people are taking perhaps they have less of a support network, maybe they're seeing their friends a bit less, maybe they can't see their family as frequently as they would have before, are you seeing that that's perhaps having an impact on some of the support network and the attachments they have? And are you seeing an increase in cases now, or how has it been affecting you?
Yes, generally, July and August are normally quiet months for counselling because people are going on holiday, going away. We'll do something about it in September. It's like December. We don't get much in December, but January we get lots. And I had 100% increase this year on last year, July, August. Goodness. Not just sex addiction, generally. Yeah. But yes, it's... not sure, completely sure why, but maybe they're not able to keep to their normal routines. They have far more time, opportunity, time to themselves. They haven't got boss around the corner looking over their shoulder, all of that sort of stuff.
And there's a lot of anxiety. There's been a lot of anxiety.
Yes.
Also.
Yes. And one of the things that people will go, the triggers that send the addict into his acting out will be stress, loneliness, boredom, rows with the partner, any of those things that upset us, or we're bored, or we just feel down. There's not much to interest us in life. They're triggers. So we work on triggers a lot so that clients can set up a situation where they can avoid them. And we work out plans for if they are triggered, how they get away from that trigger without going into acting out behaviours. So there's quite a lot of behavioural work in the early stuff.
Gosh, it sounds really similar. I don't want to trivialise it, but you know, when people are dieting and stuff, that keeps you busy and not going for the biscuit tin to entertain themselves. Yes,
or you don't have the biscuit tin.
Opportunity.
One of the big things with porn is that we get them to put blockers on all their phones and iPads, so that all the adult sites are blocked. But they keep popping up, these sites, and they have to then keep re-blocking them. Generally, they have an accountability partner who is emailed with all the sites they've looked at. So if you really want to do this, it's quite a lot of work to get into recovery. The 12-step fellowships like Alcoholics Anonymous are great. There's Sex Addicts Anonymous, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and I encourage my clients to do that, as well as see me, and as well as, if they can afford it, to go on a crash course, like a drying out course, for usually about a week for sex addicts.
Is that they just go without for a week, like go cold turkey?
Yes, they go cold turkey, and they're in a group, so they work together. They work at looking at their patterns, and they learn. Basically, they learn about sex addiction. They come out of that with a group support, and then they come to somebody to work weekly with getting into recovery.
And is this also then part of the NoFap movement?
NoFap's one of the American ones, but yes, there's quite a few. There's Your Brain on Porn is another very similar one. But the NoFap is particularly for porn, and it's, I don't know if people know what NoFap is, but it comes from the noise that you make when you masturbate. It's the sort of fap, fap, fap noise. So NoFap is what it says. It's about stopping all forms of masturbation and porn. I think they do 30 days. But I've had a guy recently, he didn't do NoFap, but he decided when it all hit the fan, he went 30 days with no sex with his partner, everything, just nothing. And he did that, and that was then the start of his recovery.
Gosh, I do find it interesting, because some people as part of that movement seem to abstain completely.
Yes.
I hadn't realized that they would completely abstain even though they had a partner. I'm interested in that.
Well, he negotiated that with his partner. I mean, partners is in that whole other area of this. I really enjoy is the wrong word, but I really like working with partners too. And partners, if the addict is going to get through this and he is in a relationship, it's very important how that dynamic with the partner works, because some partners will immediately throw them out. You know, they've discovered a hugely traumatic set of things have been going on. Sex addicts lie. Most addicts lie. It's part of the course. They've learned to lie probably from their backgrounds. So it's about being truthful in even the smallest ways, like, did you put the bins out? Yes. No, I didn't. Rather than, you don't lie about anything. Because once you lie about the bins, you could lie about anything.
Oh, gosh. Is that what you sort of would teach in your recovery then?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm. It's about behaving as a trustworthy person.
Do they lie out of self-defense because they'll get in trouble, or do they lie out of shame, or is it a whole mixture of things?
Shame, a lot of it is shame. Shame is huge. Shame fuels more addiction, really. But often people have learnt to lie in their past. They've learnt that it's their way of managing difficult situations, having to be careful about what does this person need to hear me say. They've often been over-adultified. You know, they've been made into adults too young. And they have to say the right thing to mum in front of mum and the right thing to dad in front of dad. And they just learn to do it.
I think even like culture, society, I think for a long time has encouraged people to lie in work. Otherwise, you know, you might get kind of fired or whatever. And I think I've seen more recently, you've got people like, is it Brené Brown? Who's kind of
Brené Brown, yes.
Vulnerability, and actually, you know what, we should be transparent, and having that vulnerable quality is actually really useful. People really trust you. So I think even just in society, movements are sort of changing a bit, where we're allowed to be a bit more sort of open and upfront.
Yes. Yeah, and we're encouraged to be, aren't we? Yeah, there's that business about whether you trust. most part, I mean, trust is just so difficult after something like that. And after an affair, I deal with, just generally, I deal with affairs a lot of the time. But how can you trust that your partner is actually doing this and is in recovery? And it's no good for him to say, yes, I've stopped, I won't do it again. She has to see a different person. She has to see somebody that's not just sober, but just different, more mature, who's listening and really wanting to know, who's talking about himself and his feelings, who's, you know, stopped all the old things he used to do, like come to bed really late or disappear off to the shed at every afternoon, you know, any of those things. But trust is really difficult, really difficult. They're looking, if you're looking to trust, you should look for honesty, intimacy, you know, getting closer, genuine honesty and empathy, that they're really interested in you, because that then you know you've got a different guy growing in front of you.
How do the partners respond? Is it them initiating this treatment with you, or is it generally the people affected? What's their stance when they come into this process?
I think most men come into the process because they've been found out. Mm-hmm. Something dramatic has happened. So the first thing you deal with is the crisis. Some are sent by their partners, and some really don't want to be there. When you meet a guy for the first time, you're assessing his motivation. You're assessing where he is on the contemplation scale. Is he actually not even contemplating stopping? In which case, there's really no point in doing the work at that point. Is he pre-contemplation? Is he talking about thinking about doing it, or is he actually ready to take action? Sometimes if they've been sent, you can't really say that they have started to take action. They've come because of the crisis. It's when they choose to come on their own and they start going to SLA, they start doing all the things that you're putting in place, you know, the mindfulness. Putting in place is another thing. You have to put a lot in place. If you take something away, you've got to put something in its place. So a lot of the work is on self-care, on positive relationship with yourself, with health, with fitness, with well-being, mindfulness. Some people, if they've got a religion, will pray. They will journal. They will free flow write every morning when they get up. All those sort of things are new to them, and they're replacing the time they used to spend in the bubble.
And it's interesting because I know, again, we're talking very much about men, and it does seem like I was reading Grayson Perry's Descent of Man, and what was apparent there was that boys and men are taught from a very young age, don't talk about your feelings, man up, all this very sort of toxic masculinity. And is that why perhaps they only come to seek help quite often when they've been found out? They won't come before that.
Yes, I think so. I think because they just wouldn't, it wouldn't be something that they would know how to do. They only do it when they're down and out. They wouldn't know how to do it. And that's a lot of that is in the attachment. One guy I'm working with, he had a very Roman Catholic, don't talk about sex, don't bring girls home, boarding school upbringing. And he began to use porn at boarding school. Never, ever would talk about it to anyone. And he remembers being about, sort of just out of university, maybe just going to university, and being in the house on his own. His parents were away a lot, and he just decided to ring a sex worker, and that was the beginning of the journey that went from porn to sex workers. And that was when he was about 20, and he's now in his 40s, so that's 20 years.
Gosh.
But yes, he wouldn't have known where to begin to talk about it, because you weren't allowed to talk about it. And boys at boarding school just laugh about it. And you have to protect yourself. You have to be in with that crowd, or be, you know, be lost if you're not in with the crowd.
I don't know how. I've got a 12-year-old son, and I do worry about perhaps not now, but as he goes through his teens, the sort of effect of the availability of pornography, and what that will have on his development, his peer group's development. Is that something you have any thoughts on?
I think it is dangerous for some, But if you think about something like smoking pot, a lot of teenagers smoke pot, and it's not a danger to them all. And it's the same with porn. I'm sure most 99.9% of teenagers watch some porn, but not all of them get addicted to it. We often ask, one of the questions we ask is if there are any addictive cycles in the family, if anybody else has been addicted to anything, because there is generally a predetermination to an addictive gene if it's in the family. But not always, but sometimes. But I think it's dangerous just from the point of view of the way that male teenagers see women and view sex. Mm-hmm. And actually, the girls they're going to first start having sex with are not going to be anything like those porn stars.
No.
And nor are they. They aren't going to get that sort of confident erection. I don't know whether you watched that Sex Education on television. It was on Netflix, I think. It's excellent. The mother is actually a sex therapist, but the boy is really unsure of himself sexually, and that shows the, you know, how difficult it is to be a young lad trying to be sexual. And I think porn makes that even harder.
But must be so difficult. Sorry, Leif, go on.
Sorry, but maybe with things like there are more shows like Sex Education. There's a lot more shows for younger people that are trying to kind of be more inclusive, more educational. Maybe the future generations, maybe they won't have so many issues because they're talking about it more. It seems like they can express more.
Yes, I think you're right. I think the fact that although they are watching porn, they are actually also getting the other side of the equation, aren't they? And there's a lot more normalising the fact that sex can be difficult, isn't easy, that we do have worries about it, and so do other people.
Yeah, I think that's like, I remember having sex education in secondary school, and apart from putting the condom on the banana and stuff, I really vividly remember my teacher saying, oh, you know, never mind all that, sex is basically quite funny. And I thought that was quite nice in a way, and has held true for me as an adult, you know, that it's quite a funny kind of process sometimes, and getting all stressed out about it isn't good. And I think like porn is very serious, isn't it, a lot of the time, and the expectations in porn are very serious. So I think it is nice for young people to have that sort of contrast and definitely lower their expectations, Mig.
I think so.
There's such a variety though, isn't there? I think anything you can think of, you can type it in and there'll be some kind of inanimate objects or whatever. Or like, do you see this sort of variety of different types of sexual activity?
Yes. Most of them start with fairly vanilla porn.
Mm-hmm.
But then for example, spanking might be something that somebody's really into. And then it will get harder core, or you know, they need more. And what happens online is that while you're watching, other little pictures flash up all the time of something that's just a bit more. And I was talking to a guy the other day who will watch porn and masturbate for hours and hours and hours. He very rarely stays very long. He doesn't stay with a story. He just flicks from one to the other, just catching the really intense sexual moment and then looking for the more intense sexual moment. So whereas I think perhaps when you have a magazine, you can't do that, can you? You've only got the two pictures or three pictures or the sort of story in cartoon form in front of you. Whereas online, you can go anywhere.
I think this is kind of echoed in all of our entertainment, isn't it? Because you've got TikTok where it's just a few seconds of video each time. And if you're watching television, you're on your phone at the same time doing something in multi-device usage. It's an excess of choice can be quite overwhelming, overstimulating.
Yes. And I think our brains are geared to be stimulated. We needed stimulation right back in, you know, as mammals, as animals. They look for stimulation. If you think of animals, you know, my cats are always looking for something new, something to play with, something to do. So our brains are geared for that. But of course, they didn't realise that we were going to have all these things to contend with.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't evolved quick enough to become desensitised. All these applications, you know, they know how to get us clicking away. you know, have teams of people to make sure that that we're clicking in there and manipulating us into watching these things.
Yes.
Obviously they make money from that.
Yeah.
You said you worked a lot with the partners of people who have sex addictions, porn addictions. If there's someone listening now and they think their partner may have a problem, what kind of steps could they take to support them? And, you know, what things have sort of helped them come to terms with the situation?
I would certainly not accuse and shame. I mean, as I said before, if you start to be negative with your partner and be shaming about something that you think they're doing, like watching porn, that's just going to push them further into it. But you do need to start to try and talk to them about it, and talk to them about it in a way that feels as if you are concerned for them and for your relationship. That sounds easy, and it's not. And I have to say that some women come and see me when they can't get their husbands or partners to to admit that they've got a problem. And that's, if they won't admit they've got a problem, then you're not likely to be able to do an awful lot about it. I usually will work with one or other, not both, either the man or the woman, if it's a male, heterosexual, female-male couple. And if I see the addict, I would suggest that the partner goes to somebody else who's also sex addiction trained, so that she gets some support from somebody that knows about addiction and particularly sex addiction. And then I might see them together occasionally, perhaps every third week or something, for them to be able to talk about the things that they need to talk about as a couple, which are not just to do with his recovery and her managing his recovery, but are to do with the relationship bit of this. It might be that they've had they've not been able to be sexual since this came out. She's not wanted sex. Might be the opposite. Sometimes there's a real honeymoon period where they become very sexual together, like a reclaiming of each other. So it can go either way.
And is that seen as a good thing that they're reconnecting, or is it just offsetting the stimulus that they were getting before from the pornography? And
no, it's different. It isn't generally. Okay. I think it's, if it's done with the guy really embracing recovery, it can be therapeutic, particularly if the sexual relationship was with porn rather than other women, because I think it's harder when there have been multiple affairs to have that sexual honeymoon. Although I say that, I work with affairs a lot, and again, it's 50-50. Some don't go back to sex, some go straight back to sex, and it helps them repair.
Fortunately, I haven't lived through an affair. I imagine that must be incredibly difficult to bounce back from. Do you see a lot of success in treating couples?
Yes, but I guess I only see the ones that come for help. But yes, generally, they come for help. It's crisis containment. And there's a lot of behavioural stuff in helping them to, particularly the, let's say the woman's had the affair, helping her to manage his distress, his question asking, his shame at being the cuckolded male, you know, all of that. The rules are you just have to keep answering the questions again and again and again and again. And the guy that says, you've got to draw a line under this and move on, that's not going to work.
Answer them honestly. Honestly. 100%. Yeah.
100%.
Oh, gosh.
Get it all out there.
Imagine there'd be huge temptation to...
Most of them drip feed. But drip feed, they lie, and then they let a bit more out. They lie. That won't work. It causes more problems than...
Oh, blimey. Yeah. You must sit through a lot of pain, Meg, in your job.
But the outcomes are great. You know, when they work at it, the outcomes are great. That's why I do it, you know. And I think if they come for help and they're both prepared to look at themselves and understand how it affected the other and perhaps why they had the affair or why they became addicted to chat lines, there's a real opportunity for something new. I always preach that. Once you come to me, your relationship's done, dusted, over, gone. We're starting something new. We're going to create a new relationship.
And what are the sort of success rates with people with sex addiction? Like, do many people relapse, or is it pretty, like, recovery is pretty successful?
All of those. Bearing in mind that I've not been doing it that many years, but I've been working with a guy now for nearly 2 years, and he's had three relapse withdrawals. But that's part of the process. He's still in recovery. He's still doing all the right things and going to it. He's not completely given up and gone back to just where he was. But the slips are awful because they think they've lost the plot. But slips are good because you learn from them. You can learn, why did that happen? And then, you know, you build on it.
And do you feel that, because it made me think that actually, like, our culture sort of, it kind of encourages addiction in terms of addiction to coffee, watching programs, but it's kind of seen as all right, it's socially acceptable. We kind of maybe don't realise they're actual addictions because they're allowed. Mm. How do you think we can kind of just become less addicted just generally?
Ooh.
Or is that too big?
A bit philosophical for me. How can we become less? I don't know.
Okay.
You're right. We are. I mean, I talk about being addicted to... I'm addicted to my glass of wine every evening. You know, I'm addicted to tennis. So those sort of things, you know, we do too much of, but... Our brains are wired to seek reward. So I guess we've just, as you said before, we've just got too much stimulus around us, too much opportunity for reward, for good feelings. But if you think about the guys back in the early 1900s, they didn't have much time for anything other than work and find food and create the next child, and that was about it, wasn't it?
Yeah.
With the rise of AI and automation, we're gonna have even more time on our hands. So
yeah,
what addictions are we gonna I'm not asking to predict that.
We've spoken to a lady who done research with sex workers, and in her research she was saying that quite a lot of the men form, or they feel like they form, relationships with the prostitutes that they spent time with.
That's true.
That surprised me at the time, because I was just imagined they went there for the physical act, and then that wasn't such a big aspect for them. But it sounds like in your work as well, that's a bigger feature than we might expect.
One guy who visited sex workers said to me that the best bit, the build-up and the planning, is always important. That's more important actually than the sexual act, the actual orgasm at the end. Usually then immediately they go into shame, or God, I'm never going to do this again. But his favorite bit was the minute he entered the room, she put her phone away, and that was the best bit about it for him.
Because he felt like he had somebody her full attention.
Full attention.
That's quite poignant, really, isn't it?
It is, isn't it?
But then that's the thing, I think we were so conditioned to believe all men are just, you know, about objectifying, or are basically quite cold and machine-like. And actually, you know, I mean, we've all probably got, you know, male friends, and they're just as sort of into the, what do you call it, sort of narrative or romance as a lot of women. So I think, again, as women, I feel like I've been sort of conditioned to think a man is a certain way when they're not. They're just as varied as women are.
Yes.
And you can get women as well who have those sort of masculine traditional features as well. So I think we have to be careful about trying to stereotype.
Yes, I agree with you. And I think it's probably the ones that come for help are less so the love addicts than the porn and sex, acting out sexually addicts. And I suppose in my practice, the other side of that with the men is the ones that build a relationship. They're not real relationships, but they are chat lines, just lots of different chat lines. They are aroused sexually and they do masturbate to them, but it's about the connection, the talking, the erotic, being able to be sexual with a woman.
Do you think that sex workers or any of these sort of outlets for sexual activity, I suppose, have a positive role in society, or is it always negative in your view?
Well, I think porn can be positive. sex therapists will sometimes prescribe watching some porn with your partner to aid arousal. So, you know, and a lot of couples use porn for arousal, and they have, you know, they it's part of their sex play. They're not addicted to it. So I think at some levels, porn can be useful. But when it comes to the level I'm talking about, then no. Sex workers, well, they've always been around, haven't they? Since, I guess, they fulfill a need for people who perhaps don't have access to a positive relationship sexually with somebody. So I wouldn't like to say completely that I would be against it. Them at all.
Mm-hmm. I suppose it's like being anti-chocolate, isn't it? Like a little bit of chocolate is quite nice.
Yeah, but I'm not the moral police. I always say that I'm not the moral police. I'm not here to say that what you're doing, you know, is you should not, one should not watch porn. If you want to watch porn, that's absolutely fine. But if you've come to me, you probably don't because of the way it's affecting you.
Can you tell me about like a positive experience that you've had with someone that you've treated and how they've managed to adapt and change?
I had a chap that he was into a particular type of pornography, and he was found out, and he came to me, and we did all the, but from the day he said he was going to stop, he stopped, and he hasn't gone back to it. He's had some moments where he felt he was going to slip. He puts everything in place, and we're now probably a year down the line, and I just check in with him occasionally, and he's doing okay. And but the good bit about that is that how the work I've done with him, and I've seen his partner on getting their relationship back together through that negative period, that's been good.
I love how you talked about people sort of putting self-care in place, like fitness journaling. I imagine if you put all that energy and time that you had with pornography or your addiction, whatever that was, into all these other things, you must come out of it a much more resilient, stronger, fitter person, or at least that could be the case.
Yes, they feel they like themselves much more at the end of it. And some of those things they've never done before, and they're going back to things. One guy has taken up the guitar, so sometimes when he's stressed he plays his guitar. Cycling and walking are obviously big ones they do. Guitar, art. One chap has gone back to painting, and he's spending time painting, so they're putting other things in that they can do, and they can share some of those with partners if they're in a relationship.
And I know that you mentioned that they can have a sort of, they can buddy up with someone or have that person that they're accountable for. I feel like that sounds like quite a good idea, because quite often if you try and do something yourself and you don't have anyone to kind of show,
really hard.
It can be really difficult. So having a support network is sort of key, isn't it?
It is. It is. Support network would be people that they have met. One guy in particular, he goes to two or three SLA groups, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and within those groups he's made some good connections. They're called fellowship groups because they are about making healthy, positive relationships with people, but people you can be yourself with, because you don't have to hide that side of yourself. So he's got two or three people that he can ring. In fact, the fellowships encourage you to do outreach calls every day, to ring people to talk to them, or they ring you, and so you've always got somebody you can talk to. You have like an official sponsor who helps you, is your sort of mentor. He comes to me once a week, and he has some old friends as well who know about his situation. And then the people that he did the weeks intensive with, they formed a little group, and one of them is his accountability partner. So that he's got a really good network of people around him. And you wouldn't manage without it, I don't think.
And what should couples do if they're just not having sex?
The fact that a couple have not had sex for many, many years. So we will set up, we'll talk about it. You're talking about sex is the important thing rather than doing it. If you're not doing it, it's not so important as if you're not talking about it. So we just get talking about it. And then making them comfortable talking with about it, because couples at the explicit sort of level that I can talk to them about it, it really frees them up. And we talk about what we you know, what's your sex life like now? What did it used to be like when you first met? What would you like it to be like? We do this thing called a charm circle, where I ask them to write all the things they would like and all the things they definitely wouldn't like, but the things they might like to experiment with. And we just, you know, just have a big, and we laugh about it. As long as you can laugh about it, it's great.
Wow. You must know so much intimate details about the people you work. They must have to trust you so much, Meg.
Well, it's quite a privilege, actually, to be trusted in that way, or to be shared with in that way. I think it is a privilege, because, not many people hear some of the things that you hear.
I love the idea of that, a charm circle, where you sort of put your wish list for things you like with your partner.
It's like a circle divided into slices, like a pizza, and you have sex we have now, sex we used to have, sex I'd like to have, sex that's not okay. There's another one. Can't remember. And they fill it in on their own, and then we come back and talk about it.
That's so nice.
Always do with a new partner.
Let's get my marker pens out, post-it notes. This is a win-win for me. Is that something that couples could do together, do you think? Or do you think it would be too
important? Yeah, it's great. If they can go away and talk like that. Yeah, they don't have to have me there to do it. Just opens up the conversation, because sometimes we get stuck in the same old rut, don't we? And we might think that our partner... Oh, I tell you something else. That's one thing with the addiction, that the partner often thinks that their addicted partner wants them to have the same sort of sex that they've been looking at.
Okay.
But that isn't the case. They often say that the sexually addicted spouse, for example, will say, "This is nothing about what I feel about you. What I do has nothing to do with what I feel about you. It's more to do with my own feet, what's going on inside me." Although he can't put that into words. I tend to put that into words. It's that wound he's got that he's trying to soothe. Doesn't mean he doesn't love his partner, although that's very hard to understand. So a lot of those fantasies that we have, they give us that sexual urge, but we would never want to act them out.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the point, is their fantasies, and you're supposed to be in a safe space, or you're visualize. It's a safe space. It doesn't mean you want to actually act that out. Or it's like people that play violent video games. It doesn't make them violent. It's an urge in our brains, I think, just to experiment in some way that when you're not actually doing it, it's just a safer space to do that.
Meg, I think we've covered so much stuff. Is there anything that you think we haven't touched upon that we should ask you about, or that would be...
Well, I'd like to give you some places to go if you are struggling, you know, some places to go. And I don't know whether you can put these up on your site or something.
Yeah, definitely. But we can put them on the podcast
The first place I would go if you're either a partner or worried that you've got a problem is to an association called ATSAC, ATSAC. That's the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Addiction and Compulsivity. And on their site, you will find everything. You'll find a list of counsellors who are trained. You'll find all about the fellowship programmes and the courses that you can do. Then you've already mentioned nofap.com. There's ybop.com, yourbrainonporn.com. That's a book as well. And the fellowships, SLAA, again, just Google SLA and it'll come up. And SAA, I think there's another one, SA, but those are the two that I know best and I'm comfortable with. Start with ATSAC. They'll give you lots of information. And that they are, that I'm a member of their, qualified member of their association. That's my training body.
Brilliant. And where do you practice, Meg? Whereabouts are you based?
Well, everything's online at the moment. Okay. But I'm based in East Sussex and West, on the East Sussex-Kent border.
And if people wanted to talk to you about treatment, is that something that's an option at the moment?
Yeah, I'm MickBennettRelationshipCounselling.co.uk. I've got a website.
Brilliant. We can link to that below as well. Oh, that's so fantastic, Mick. It's so much broader than I ever would have
it's
thought.
It's huge, isn't it? Actually, just talking to you, I had no idea how long it was going to take, but this,
Oh, that's so interesting, Mick. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for your time.
I really enjoyed it. I hope I haven't too much.
It's fantastic. No, it's brilliant. Oh, lovely meeting you, Mick. Have a lovely
Bye.
Evening.
Very nice
Take
to
care.
Talk to you.
Speak soon then. Bye.
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 Bye, Lee. Bye.
Bye. I'll stop recording.
Curious Talks with Leif and Elfie.
Follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Leif and Elfie.